There's a journalist or writer or general all-around creative that I really like named Craig Maude. And I've probably referenced him on the show before. I think about him a lot because what I appreciate about him is the way that he does things a little differently sometimes, or at least tries to think outside of the kind of normal ways of doing things online today. And he is doing that right now, and it's something that I found very notable and I wanted to share with you. He is taking a journey through Japan, a walking trip that will take him, I think, about a month. And the way that he's communicating to the outside world is not by tweeting, and it's not even by emailing people a newsletter. He created a bespoke text messaging setup that you could sign up for, and he'd text you once or twice a day a little short essay about what he had experienced and a photo. And I thought that was kind of cool. I hadn't heard of anybody using text messaging that way before. It feels kind of old school, which is a funny thing to say about like texting, because I know it's still a new school thing. But the idea of a like text, what is that called? You know, like that used to be a thing, right? Like sign up for texts. Like that's how Twitter started.
That's actually the technological origin of the 140 character limit.
Right.
Because SMS is 160 characters and they needed the other 20 for metadata. But this is much more of a rich content experience via SMS then.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, when's the last time someone said to, like, sign up for texts? I can't recall.
Right.
But I feel like that was a thing for a few years, maybe almost 10 years ago at this point, was these companies that were wanting to, you know, send you texts all the time. And they would always have all that weird little rules and regulations type bonus copy of international rates may apply, check with your carrier to see if text messaging is free, blah, 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 blah.
Reply stop in all caps.
Yes, too. Yes, yeah. Yes. And I can do that with these Craig Maude texts, is if I want to, I can say stop, and they will never come back. And I've always, that is such a good thing about text message group replies like this. The very urgent yelling way that you can get them to stop arriving on your phone. But that was an interesting experiment that is, well, it's an ongoing experiment. I'm still getting them every day. That made me think about the fact that there's just no tried and true way of publishing online today. And this is something that I'm working with a few clients right now. They're saying, how do I communicate with my audience? And there just isn't, at least in my opinion, a single answer that I would tell every person. And there is not a single platform that I would recommend. And in fact, the fact that the platforms are so messy right now is part of why it's so challenging to figure out, which is why there's something kind of fun and charming about saying, I'm just going to shoot you a text in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's actually being very explicit. He's like, feel free to reply to this. I'm not going to see them. I think he might do something with them. It seems like he's going to publish a like one-off book just for him that will include some of the replies he got. But you're sending your reply into the void and knowing that you're not going to get a response back. So this is a very one-sided conversation that he's holding, where that alone feels different from Twitter, where it seems like you can say anything to anybody and maybe it'll make it to them. Maybe not, but maybe. I don't know. It has made me think through the ways of publishing now and the way of communicating with an audience and talking to people and getting an idea out into the world. And I'm realizing that that feels harder than it did a few years ago, at least to me. How do you feel about that?
I find it really frustrating that there is no true way. There is no clear answer to this question. I always have found it frustrating. But part of what's frustrating for me is that I do have answers for myself about how I would like to read and how I would like to write. And it's the same. Just spoiler alert, harkening back to our conversation with Manton Reese, it's the web. and RSS as a way of crawling the web all the way through from the day I discovered it in 2002 or whenever it was. That has always seemed like the right answer. The only reason why more options have proliferated and why I have this frustrating situation of having to read and write in multiple ways, it seems to be a problem on the receiving end. You know, publishing will clearly do whatever it needs to do in order to reach people, as the social media era has shown us, as the era of blogs that made money shortly before that showed us, and as interesting new business models like the one that that I just got hired to write for are showing us now, which is email newsletters as a publication that people subscribe to by topic. Readers just keep checking their email, you know, no matter what else they're also checking. And so it's become obvious that that's one way to reach them where they are. Obviously, the lion's share of the attention goes to Facebook and to an Instagram and to a much lesser extent Twitter, but Twitter has the same problem, which is that it's got a critical mass of attention. So it becomes a place where people have to publish because it's where certain readers are. But all along, like I said, RSS has seemed like the obvious answer. And the reason why, I think, is similar probably to the reason that Craig Mott has chosen SMS, which is that it's fundamental and cross-platform. The reason I think RSS is the answer is because it is a technology built on top of the web, which is something you know everyone with a computer has access to. And, you know, even if people don't use an RSS reader, they can still go to your website and read your stuff on the web. It doesn't matter what kind of computer it is. It doesn't matter if it's a big screen or a small screen. The web can serve all those people. And I guess email can too, because email is something that came to mobile devices as early on as the web did, if not before. I think email is seen as something that everyone can get everywhere, and it doesn't matter who your email provider is, for example. So you can know that anybody with an email address can receive your email that way. And this thing Craig Mott is doing with messaging seems to be a sort of micro version of that, where everybody's also using messaging. And there's something interesting about that. Obviously, the modern futuristic version of receiving rich content via messaging is something like what Apple is pushing with iMessage, where, you know, you communicate with businesses that way, and there's increasingly more effects and applications running inside of message threads. And I can imagine a fairly rich publishing, subscribing environment in messages, but it just doesn't seem quite right to mix publishing and communication in the same place to me. And even Facebook decided to split those things up. What do you think the difference is between publishing into messages the way that Craig Mott is and sharing and discussing the way that I think most people do?
Yeah, that's a good question. If I can try to get into the mind of Craig Mott and why he's doing this, I think that the reason why publishing via text message works is because it feels so conversational. Mm-hmm. And what I have felt over the last few years is this overwhelming deluge of articles and hot takes and new pieces to read. And it's kind of devalued the idea of an article, which is an overgeneralization, right? That's not necessarily the truth, but I think that maybe is how people feel. And so saying subscribe to me via RSS is just not a thing anymore. Like, that doesn't happen. So come to my Medium blog and read my articles feels like that's not really got a great chance. And then let me post once a day every time that I write one of these to Twitter and Facebook also feels bad, because it feels like you're sending this important thing that you've worked on into just the floodwaters and they're going to get swept away. And so saying, let me text you once a day, I mean, I've seen them all because they're texts to me. It's the ultimate push notification, right? There's no algorithm in my text messages that's keeping them at bay or only showing me a select few. And the fact that creatives are fighting more and more these algorithms, which are keeping the people who have subscribed to them from seeing what they are creating, it seems like a problem to me. Moving from text to videos, I feel like YouTube might be the best example of this, where they now have like multiple subscription systems all nested on top of each other. Mm-hmm. So if you want to follow somebody on YouTube, you can subscribe to their channel, but subscribing to their channel doesn't necessarily mean that they'll send you or show you the things that that person is making, especially if you subscribe to hundreds of channels, which I'm sure a lot of people do. So then they added the bell, which is a way to say, I want to get push notifications whenever this person is creating something. So you subscribe and then you click the bell. But if you click the bell, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will send you a push notification every time somebody subscribes. And so people have been saying, like, maybe there needs to be another step up above that. That's like, I think someone said like a super bell or like a preference within the bell that says, I really, really want every single thing that this person says delivered to me. But that is completely sidestepped by text messaging. I'm just getting them all. And of course, we know, you and I know, that RSS also sidesteps that, right? If I subscribe to something via RSS, it just gives me all of them forever. But that is like not a normal idea in 2019. That's not something that people are doing. And we all fought the algorithmic timelines for a good while, but that fight was obviously lost. And there's nothing that shows me that that's coming back around and we're going to have the normal timeline where everything is in order and everything is seen again. So it puts people who are creatives in a hard situation. And I think that's kind of the main problem is I know when I send somebody a message in a chat window that they're going to get that message. But when I try to upload an article or a video or a photo to the internet, I am not sure if people are actually going to see that or not. And the former feels much better than the latter.
The thing about using messages for it, though, is that, I mean, you said that it feels conversational. And like that, well, it's not true in the case of the Craig Mod one, right? So it creates this sort of illusion that you're getting this intimate personal message directly from the person, or I guess you are getting it directly, but it's still one way. It's cool that that's what people want. I think that is what people want, to be tapped directly in, and that's the promise on which people signed up for social media in the first place, right? Is like they wanted to follow along with the people that they're subscribing to as though they were part of their lives. But the publisher issue that you point to of like needing to make sure that people can see your stuff, like that is a clearer explanation to me of why messaging appeals to someone as a way of publishing, because you know for sure they got it. And that even brings up the sort of question of read receipts. And like, you know, if you were to use Facebook Messenger, say, to send people original content, you would know exactly who read it and you would know when they read it. And, you know, email newsletters have tracking for that sort of thing too, but it's a lot less reliable because it's not a closed loop. And, you know, maybe that anxiety about being sure that people saw stuff is a factor for publishers determining how hard they push a particular technology, like among the ones that we're talking about. And I know for a fact from the inside that the business end of a lot of publishing operations is strongly disinclined to use RSS precisely because of the uncertainty about whether people saw something or not, or whether it's working. And like, of course, if they click through on something, then you see. If what you're posting is just something for people to read, you know, you get no information about that. I understand that publisher anxiety, to be sure, because that's what the whole business is based on. But the capriciousness of users, of readers, let's say, listeners, viewers, has had a terrible, traumatic effect on the confidence of publishing, at least as much as the capriciousness of the platforms, like this stuff that YouTube's doing that you're describing, this constant tweaking of business models, like that creates existential anxiety from the publisher's point of view. Like, how do I know that the way that I'm making money off of this today is going to be the way I make money off of it tomorrow? But on the other side, you know, the new hot thing coming along and people going and spending all their attention on it and then expecting everybody to come to them, that's destructive to the voice and identity of publishers also. And at a certain point, at least with the latter part, I think that publishers have to stand up against it by making a choice that this is what kind of publication that we have. And I think that there are a lot of voices for that on the indie web side, some of whom we've talked to on this show, saying the web is the place and that's where I'm going to be. And if you want to come to me and get it, that's great. And if you don't, like, I'll just build tools to push it to you where you are. But ultimately, this is where it lives. Hi, Internet friends. It's John here. Internet Friends is brought to you by my work at Ablaze Interactions, where I solve communication problems for clients who work to repair our world. I can help with information architecture to transform your website, content strategy to tell the right story and reach the right audience, and writing and editing to find the authentic voice of your company or organization, your product, or your idea. Ablaze Interactions has consulted for world-renowned events, political candidates, law firms, nonprofits, and great apps on the App Store. Light up your ideas. Go to ablaze.co and let me know if you're interested in working together. Comments are not as good as replies to messages. I think we all know that by now. And like, I sometimes turn comments on for specific blog posts and then I have them close after a month. And, you know, that's like the most I can handle as far as comments. The whole time I was at Burning Man, I was trying to get them to turn comments off on the blog and no one would do it because it was a dumpster fire and it was a spam target and everything. So that maybe that gets back to what you were trying to say, which is like the personal aspect of using a messaging tool of some kind to publish that at least enables theoretically an actual conversation. I think there's something to be said for that. And I think that it is a better model. Like if you're posting publicly on the web, great. Posting an article on the web or a video, whatever, posting your original content on the web for public consumption, that's great. I think that should be done in most cases, unless what you're offering is a subscriber only product or something. But then the conversation about that thing happening publicly on the web, I think is no good. I think that we've got plenty of evidence for that by now. Even the Twitter closed alternative like has the same exact dynamics as comments do. So is that it? Like, is that why messaging is an interesting publishing tool for you? Conversation?
Yeah, I think so. I've said that time and time again, that one of the reasons that I feel the desire to create, period, is to find community. Mm-hmm. I don't like just making things in a bubble. It is not worthwhile to me to write 500 words, publish them, and then them be seen by nobody. I desire people to see it, not necessarily for the attention, but for the community, for the feeling of being known. And that's why I find conversation preferable. And genuinely, I think why Twitter is so tricky, because even though the replies aren't very good, the replies from people who consistently reply to you feel more communal than a random one-off reply on an article.
Sure.
I should say, by the way, that as you were kind of talking about the value of sending things via text message, it's been pretty rocky for Craig. And I think a huge chunk of people just weren't getting the pictures because I imagine trying to send a nice photo to hundreds of people or however many people have signed up for this is a tricky situation.
Sure.
So they switched it to just sending a link to a photo because that was easier to do. And this is not him pulling out a phone and sending out a group text. This is some very specific custom solution that they've created that's, I'm sure, running on some weird backend specifically made to publish SMS messages at a huge clip. So this is not something that you or I could just do tomorrow if we wanted to, nor would it necessarily be something that I would want to do tomorrow. This whole conversation has made me think of a book I read recently called Masters of Doom, which is about the people who made the video game Doom back in the 90s. And one of the things that struck me about that book and the way that those games were created is that they were one of the first examples of successful shareware on the internet. So you didn't go to a store and buy a copy of Doom. You could, of course, do that eventually. But the initial way that it was released was you would go on a computer, download the game. It would give you the first few levels for free, and then you would pay to unlock the rest of the levels. And because it was this one-to-one method of distributing their video game, it kind of created a like community aspect to the game, where the people who were making it were very well known to the people who were playing it. And eventually, as people started getting really excited for Doom 2, they started releasing a daily plan file, like a dot plan file in whatever, you know, what would that have been, right? BBS or something weird, some old method of like communicating back and forth.
It was before I was online. I did play the game, but I was like a kid.
Yeah, and I too played the game, but I have no idea like how I got the game. I can't recall that part of it at all.
Right.
And I think I was young enough that I probably never got past those first few stages to realize that there was like more game after that.
Right.
Regardless, the developer, John Carmack, started releasing this dot plan file where it was basically their version of release notes. Well, not specifically release notes because it was not for new updates, but it was just to update the community on how development was going as a whole. But as more and more people started following these plan files, he started just writing little things in it to the community. And it became the de facto way of getting information to the audience about what was going on in the game. And I believe people were following the like dot plan file way more than they were following, say, magazine articles about the game's development. Mm-hmm. And it kind of felt like he struck on a very early version of publishing to an audience in a way that made sense for him at the time and made sense for the audience at the time. He didn't really need a platform beyond a place to put the file and for people to download the file. But this is sort of my both complaint, and it's something that I complain about a lot, and it's something that I'm in awe of in the internet, is that everything just feels like it just happened accidentally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I brought this up episodes and episodes ago about the weird way that Google Images and YouTube and these huge, huge websites were just kind of created for dumb reasons, like seeing Jennifer Lopez in a dress. Like, that's a weird reason for Google Images to exist, but here we are. And I sort of feel like publishing has maybe never been as thoroughly considered as it should be. Same for communication. Like, our move from SMS to iMessage was a clumsy one and is still ongoing however long later. Like, how many years old is iMessage at this point, right? And the fact that other people are still using SMS has led to my wife's family all communicating over WhatsApp and never touching a text message app because they all use Android phones. And Google Reader getting randomly killed has led to not some new thing popping up the next day, but a whole decade of people struggling to figure out how to communicate a message to a broad audience. And Facebook pivoting to video and then pivoting away from video, and then Google creating these AMP pages and like all this stuff. It just feels messy. And it's made it very challenging for people to really understand how to do things well online. And I just talk to so many creatives who ask me, you know, their first question is like, not how do I communicate a message clearly to an audience? It's like, what do I do? Mm-hmm. You know, just like straight up, what do I do here? I don't know what to do. I'm on Instagram, I guess, because that's where everybody is. But I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know what to do beyond that. And I don't think that like a clear-cut solution is coming. And email being a major solution to me is an example of that, right? Like you kind of skimmed by it earlier, but it's cool. You got this new job working for a email publication that's creating an honest-to-God publication via email. And that's really, really cool. And I'm sure has a great audience and a good readership, because it's one of the only ways to actually make sure that people see it in front of their face and get a chance to click it. But that's weird, because it's in the middle of a bunch of other strange spam ads and personal emails and who knows what else, right?
What's interesting about this company is that it is really, you say job, it is a job in that it is something I'm going to be publishing every day, but it's like a 10 item link list, basically. It's not like I haven't like gone back to the corporate world, let's say. It's going to basically be a way of monetizing my existing Apple reading habits. But the cool thing about this company is, so I got the job editing the Apple newsletter for inside.com. That's the website. And what inside.com is not actually really a publication so much as an index of publications, or a meta publication. Inside.com is a package of newsletters. Like, I don't even know how many. Like, there's newsletters kind of on every topic that you can think of, all of which are edited by someone like me. And maybe many of them are edited by one person or whatever. But, you know, the Apple position was open and I applied and they've given it to me. So I'm joining a bunch of other people, and I'm going to be on a Slack team with editors of newsletters of a bunch of topics. And the users of this service go to inside.com and find newsletters to subscribe to. And of course, like, I can send the URL just to subscribe to mine, and you could subscribe to the Apple one, and that can be all you do. But you can create an account and get a premium account at inside.com. And I just got this job like an hour ago, so I haven't fully looked into how the service works. But what it seems like they are able to do for paying subscribers is provide them a whole spread of topics that they're interested in kind of a digest form or something like that. And they also take sponsorships for the existing newsletter. So what this is, like I was saying before, is capitalizing on a trend of using email newsletters as the sort of most basic common denominator way to reach as many people as possible, because everybody's still checking their email, just like they're getting SMS messages, even if they mostly use WhatsApp to communicate. And I'm a big fan of email. I mean, basically the bulk of my job for the last 5 years was curating and writing an email newsletter that reached 200,000 people and could drive unbelievable amounts of community activity just by putting something in the email. Like, the key to an email newsletter working is that it's about something that matters to people. Maybe that's like sounds really obvious, but I'm not sure that many online publishers do take that idea seriously, that like there's no substitute for curating or publishing about something that people care a lot about. And if you're doing that, then the people who want to find it will. That only works to a certain extent, because if you're using some baroque obscure startup paid podcasting app, you know, like, that's the news this week. I haven't even bothered to read it because of how little I care about Netflix for podcast style applications and all this crap that's coming out that's trying to turn podcasting into a closed medium the way that so many other internet companies have done. If you get all married to Anchor or whatever to post your podcast, or SoundCloud may even be a good example, if you go too far in that direction of pushing the envelope and being on the, you know, newest, edgiest startups thing, because probably they convinced you to, you won't be able to reach people anymore. And that's a real risk. So, like, that's why I put my foot down so hard on like the web and email as the place to be, because people will be able to get to you if they want. But the thing that you said about the Doom plan file brings in, I think, what the other key element of it is. And I also think that it is it's part of what you answer to your clients who are like, what am I even doing here? Which is that the medium really should serve the community and not the other way around. You know, like, every attempt I've ever been a part of to say, let's make a big Facebook group for this thing that we do, like, let's try and be big on Facebook, or let's try and be big on Instagram, has failed. That's not how you do it. What you do is, let's try and serve this community that exists as fully as possible, or coalesce the people who would be into this into a community. And you do that by serving them with the media that makes sense to them. And because these Doom players were downloading shareware off the internet, including a file in that bundle that had information in it, made perfect sense as a thing to do. It's not something that, you know, the New York Times could have done, but it was exactly the right thing to do for Doom players. And so I thought about and actually worked on in the 2013, 2014 days when I was doing a lot of music in the Bay Area and sort of trying to piggyback on the general kind of Burning Man centric art scene I was in to make kind of a new way of online indie music happen. I was obsessed at that time with the potential for podcasting in music because podcasting was just kind of beginning the takeoff it's still beginning, but like 2014 was really around the time that podcasts were starting to like be mentioned in the news for the first time that I could remember. And I was obsessed with this, with the dividing line between music and spoken audio and, you know, songs and albums and podcasts. And like, where is the line? Where is the difference? And one really great example of a music podcast that got going around that time was Song Exploder, which was the perfect host guest format podcast for this, where the host was a singer, songwriter, musician who knew what questions to ask and had artists on to decompose or, you know, explode, hence the name, the track that they were making the show about. And that even went so far as like literally just playing the drum track for a few seconds so that listeners could hear a part of the song that they hadn't heard before. And they would tell the story of how the song was written and recorded and released. And then at the end of the episode, you'd play the track. And I found it really engaging as a music lover. And I thought, why doesn't every band have a podcast and just do whatever? Hey, it's us. We're on the tour bus. I'm recording this with the mic on my phone. And we just had this really great idea. And, you know, we're going to like play it by like drumming on the headrests of the seats of the bus. And like, you tell us what you think. I know that artists are starved for time and need to like take that bus time to like decompress. I understand that. But the reason why it seemed to make so much sense to me is not just because podcasts are hot. It's because those people have a relationship with their fans that takes place through their ears already. So why cede some of that time to people talking about other stuff if you can give them another alternative way to engage with you the way that they already do, but about something else or in a different format? And it's not because podcasting. It's not because you have to have a podcast in order to participate in the 21st century. It's because a musician is a sound artist and there are other ways to make sound. And they could be the perfect ways to keep your fans updated on what's going on with you, in addition to publishing the stuff that they're coming to you for in the first place, the songs. And I haven't, you know, gone through one by one and figured out like for every medium, like there must be an equivalent to this. But I certainly feel like some of the answer to where to publish, if that's the question, the core question that we're asking, has to do with figuring out first where the audience is and going there. And it keeps sounding obvious when it comes out of my mouth, but I really don't think it is as obvious as it seems. Like, writing an email newsletter about Apple news with 10 headlines and like, 50 words of synopsis makes a lot of sense to me as a way of working in this Apple news world that I've wanted to be a part of for so long and was to a certain extent a long time ago. You know, I keep thinking like I should start an Apple blog, you know, I should do like another Daring Fireball style blog where I just talk about my feelings about Apple and like hope people read it. And like the reason I think that is because that's what the people who got me to love this stuff do, and they're still doing it and they're successful at it. But because this opportunity popped up, this like tweet went by that was like, these people are hiring someone to write this newsletter. That was what finally snapped me out of it and made me go, oh, I know how to write newsletters. And like, I can add value this way because not everybody is reading blogs about this, nor are they getting all the information that they want to get from their algorithmic feeds that mix in death and chaos and tragedy with whatever they're trying to read about. You know, maybe there are lots and lots of people who are into computers and have iPhones in their pockets who would read 10 line items about the Apple news of the day in their email. And I'm really optimistic about that because it's going to them where they are. It's going to their iPhone. I feel like photographers have this Instagram problem, you know, which we've talked about before, you've talked about before, of like, there is this mass medium and it's for photos. But like, what are you taking pictures of? Because you can send photos by text message, like Craig Mott is doing. So, you know, it's not an obvious thing that like, because Instagram is the hip place where people engage with photos, that you have to go there with your photos. Like, it's not necessarily the case that the people who want to see the photos of the things you take photos of want to see them there. They might want to see them somewhere else. And the thing you have to do is find them and then reach them. And maybe that's what Craig Mott did with this text message thing. I mean, there is a way in which it's like sort of perfectly twee and cute for the kinds of people who like his stuff, right?
Right, exactly.
So like, what do you think of that? Like, put yourself in the shoes of a potential client of yours who's also a photographer who says, what do I do? How would you help that person find their audience?
I am already starting to shift away from recommending them to double down on the places that they're already posting. Instagram is the main one, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Instagrammers who have a lot of followers because they take some real good photos, but they have no idea what to do with it. And I think that what I appreciated about this experiment that Craig Mott is doing is that there's no question in my mind that after this is over, I will not be seeing a post that says that was so successful that I'm switching primarily to SMS as my publication medium, right? Like, yeah. That's not going to happen. What instead it was a way to cultivate a new audience, to try something different, to do something on his own terms. And I think that finding ways that you can experimentally publish on your own terms feels so good. It feels so liberating. And I think that that feeling is not only good for the creator, but for the audience as well. And that's why I brought those .plan files into the conversation, because that is an example of somebody doing the thing that makes sense for them and doing it on their own terms and finding an audience that way. And they could have just talked to people through magazines. They were already in a place where they could have just done interviews and disseminated information that way. But it was better for them to do this too. And so the Craig Mott experiment has made me start thinking about that in my own life. What are ways in which I can do something, maybe just a small experiment, maybe a limited run thing, maybe something longer, but something that still feels like a side project that I can do on my own terms that makes me feel happy and can connect me with a new audience or just a small audience that feels invested in the stuff that I'm doing. And I don't think that looks like the same thing for everybody. I definitely won't be publishing text messages because honestly, I hate text messages. I don't like having a bunch of unread texts on my phone. So, you know, that isn't something that really works well for me. But at the same time, learning what that looks like, I think, is the important component here. And I used to be a pretty consistent publisher on Medium, and I felt that fade over time as I watched the platform grow into something that I didn't like. And in earnest, there were other reasons why I stopped writing, but that was a pretty big factor, was watching the platform that I felt like my brain understood turning into something that I didn't understand and feeling disincentivized because of that. And the more you rely on a singular platform to be the place that you do everything, I think the more you're going to feel as if that doesn't work in the long term. Hello, internet friends. It's Drew, and I want to tell you about Keyhouse. There's a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I read, tucked away in an essay he wrote about the seasons, where he said that he thought that the idea of four seasons was a lie. Instead, we should have six. Fall doesn't move to winter, and winter doesn't move to spring. Instead, he thought the season should be like so. Summer, fall, locking, winter, unlocking, and spring. I believe there's a beautiful poetry to the idea that creation itself requires a time of unlocking before anything of substance can bloom. And perhaps you're listening to this message right now, stuck between what you're doing and what you want to do for the rest of your life, realizing that you might be in that cruel season of unlocking too. Find your own space for unlocking. Go to Keyhouse, KEYHOU.SE, and let's find the key.
The key Kevin Kelly, Thousand True Fans problem to solve then is like bringing the people along with you and keeping in touch with them. And I think that, and maybe this is another thing that sounds like a cliche truism of the publishing industry, but the relationship is what matters. I think that the part of that that people don't interrogate closely enough is what you're saying, is that getting stuck in a medium or on a particular platform, which is worse than a particular medium because it's tied to the fates of a specific company and whose interests may not be aligned with yours necessarily, you lose control. And the specific control that you lose is control of like the terms of your relationship with your fans, with your people. The still really hard and unsolved part of this is, where do you maintain that relationship and where do you bring it along with you to the next thing? How do you continue to contact people and let them know about what you're doing next? And, you know, the email newsletter has like, you know, dominated the concept of the list, where a list of email addresses is like an economically valuable commodity now, because it's people who have subscribed, who have assented to be contacted about something because of their interest in whatever it is. Publishers want a relationship, and where do you maintain that relationship? And I think that really the only stable enough forms of identity to do that, that aren't married to a platform like Facebook, are email addresses and phone numbers. And of the two, email addresses, well, they're the ones that you can have as many email addresses as you want. You can set up filters and rules and stuff. You know, there you can use very advanced apps to process and filter your email for you. So it's the much, much more user-friendly way to maintain a relationship. Do you think that's good enough? Do you think email as an identifier is good enough? Like, do you feel like you have a relationship with people via email?
No, because I hate email.
Okay. That's well, what do you hate about email exactly?
What I hate about email is it's a space where 90% of the stuff is boring.
Right.
And then 10% of the stuff is randomly fun or interesting. And that doesn't feel right to me. It feels very similar to mail, where so much, I mean, it is way too similar to the actual physical mail for my comfort, which is I check it. I have to check it every day. I throw half of it in the garbage can immediately and feel weirdly guilty about it. I look at the bills that I didn't want to look at, and then I very, very rarely find a letter from somebody that I like.
And you're like, thank God I didn't throw that away by accident.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And that's why, and I guess I'll have to check it again tomorrow and every day forever, because those random letters are going to come through, or a wedding invitation or something that actually brings me joy, but the rest of it doesn't. And email is not a platform that feels joyful to me. It feels pretty boring. And I know that I myself am not great at responding to emails. I should be better at that than I am, especially right now where I'm in the middle of like a physical space renovation. I have like hundreds of unanswered emails that I need to be going through, but it's because 80 to 90% of them are meaningless or pointless or already responded to in some other format. So I don't like it. Like, I have tried multiple ways to sign up for email newsletters that feels good, and I haven't found that way for me. Not to say that email newsletters aren't good. I think that they are still the best out of everything, but I don't personally enjoy it. But this is the problem, right? Is we're having this conversation, and somewhere out there, there's a bro in Silicon Valley listening to this that says, ah, what we need is a new platform that has new identifiers for everybody.
Let's spell that out right now. We don't want a new platform.
More and more of these.
No new platforms. We're not even talking about a platform. Email is not a platform. Stop trying to make email into a platform.
Yes, exactly. And I have been decently enjoying using Apple News, but I do see the problem there too of it being a place where everything's locked in. And, you know, for a while you've been using it before me and you would occasionally share an Apple News article and it would be like a pain for me to open it because I didn't have Apple News installed on my phone. So it wasn't even like something easy to see. And their desire to lock you into their platform, just like everybody else's, is making this feel inconvenient. And my answer to all of this is that the one that does feel the best out of them all is the podcast. It's because it just feels pleasant to be able to release something into the world and know that people will get it in the ways that they get it, because people who care about podcasts have an app on their phone where they get new episodes and I don't have to worry about it. But that feels kind of gone for other mediums like photography and articles. It doesn't feel quite as easy to have a system that feels as clean and wholesome as podcasting does for audio.
Maybe not as clean and wholesome, but a guy who gets paid to write email, I'm going to come out and say it. I think email is a great medium for publishing, for things that are not audio or video, for small files. I think that and static files. I think that email is great. Maybe what's bad about email is its communication features. And like that anxiety about unanswered email that came up for you, like that, everybody's got that. I've got that. I left like 75 emails unanswered when I left my job at Burning Man. But that's for the communication aspect. That's the two-way aspect. We started off talking about messages, not email. Like maybe Craig Mod has got it inverted, because maybe messages are the way that we should be communicating with our people, with everyone. And email should be like mostly read-only with like the occasional mass message, which is something like publishing. You know, like if you're going to send something to a bunch of people, like an announcement of a the equivalent of the mail, of the physical mail, like you're talking about, like the announcement of a birth or a wedding or a death or whatever it is, you know, email is the right place to do that, because you don't want to get a text message inviting you to a wedding. You don't want to get a text message letting you know about somebody passing away. Like it's too sudden. It's too interruptive. Email is like good for big, slow things. And maybe the problems with filtering it and sorting it and prioritizing it have to do with the fact that just like the physical mail, it's communication mixed together with publication. And I kind of feel like maybe email should be thought of now as a publishing medium. Communication has moved on from email, but email's still good for something. And I think it might be good for this. I would totally subscribe to your photos by email, dude. Like I would absolutely do that. Like there's, I can't think of a better way to do that. Because then I, you know, would make sure I got them all and they would be organized by thread. You know, like what other publishing tool that you can think of has threading in it? You know, you can't like, well, except Twitter. And we know how well that's going for keeping things organized. Like email threads are kind of a cool feature. And, you know, you could have multiple conversations, quote unquote, going on at once with one person. And like, I don't know. I think email needs a rebrand.
Yeah.
Email has all this complicated psychology around it that everyone has. And I feel like that enables you as a sender of email to be more thoughtful. I think that people do it all the time, even unconsciously, because they, you know, they pack their emails full of exclamation marks and they say, sorry about not responding, even if it's been 2 days. You know, like people are trying to make email feel better for each other. And I think that's a good sign. I honestly think that's an indication that it's a humane medium. And maybe the fact that it is modeled on the physical letter is what is so humane about it, because it feels like more of an investment into an object that you're giving to someone instead of just something that will flutter by in a stream and disappear.